where the plane and on the spot where he was laid, wings of flame to burn forevermore until the end of time. To all the other soldiers, no lanterns, no guns, salute. Last post playing childhood's end was long in coming, but come at last for all our fear, for all our vanity, for all our stars. Childhood's end was long in coming, but come at last for all our fear, for all our vanity, for all our stumbling. Childhood's end childhood's end is drawing
near. How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here, God. Ugh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Ugh.
Isn't there
anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
We'll be right back.
to the right place. Media Democracy Days is a partnership of SFU School of Communication, openmedia.ca, and the Vancouver Public Library. As I mentioned before, it's been running for 14 years, and we are trying to provide a platform for people working towards two aims. The first, for those of you taking notes, is democracy of the media. That means opening the media so it can be diverse, representative, and hold power to account. The second is we're aiming to promote democracy through the media. This means making and promoting media that strives to improve the health of our democratic decision-making and our communities and our society. That could mean informing people about critical issues, or it could mean creating new ways for people to participate in public debate and collective decision-making. So, that's why we're here. That's the pitch. Before we get started, I just have to do a couple quick acknowledgments, in particular the people that made this event possible. First, our courageous staff, I'm looking for them, Il Aguilar, Marielle Guerrero, and Helena Crowbath, who have been working tirelessly to make this happen. They are heading into term paper and final exam season, so they've got lots of things to think about, but they have spent thousands of hours working on this, consumed hundreds of liters of coffee, and have written, at least me personally, 1 million emails each. So that dedication has been nothing short of inspiring, and I can just say, quite honestly, I couldn't possibly be prouder of the job they've done. We also have an amazing team of volunteers. You probably met a ton of them upstairs and downstairs. I think there's, 40, 45 volunteers that make this event happen. I can't name them all, and I won't, but I would like to name a few in particular. Matt Johnstone, Jahansib Hussein, who many of you heard from last night at the film screening, Therese Ma, Kristen Silvasi, David Petty, Marianella Ramos-Capello, who made the beautiful blue program guides that many of you have in your hands. And dozens of others that you've met on your way in. I'd like to also thank our steering committee members, in particular, the dashing and handsome co-chair, Stuart Points, who I have to say is probably one of the hardest working and most dedicated people I know. He's a professor in SFU School of Communication and has been absolutely instrumental in making this event happen. I was going to say, I think he's dedicated more time, energy, and passion into this project than even he expected to, and has skilled up a really amazing team of volunteers during a very busy time in his life. So I cannot thank Stuart enough for his leadership. Also, a great friend of mine, Kathy Cross, who until this year had to step away as chair of MDD, but dedicated also years of her life, consumed millions of liters of coffee, to turning this into a significant platform for media makers and advocates in this city. So, big thanks to them. Professor Bob... Oh. Two more, and then we're going to get on with the show. Professor Bob Hackett from SFU School of Communication, who we joke is the godfather of MDD. He may be the only person in this room, although I'm looking for challengers, may be the only person in this room who has been to every single one of MDD's events for the last 14 years. Is there anyone who can beat that? Okay, so there you go. That's Bob's claim to fame, in addition to a rich career as an academic. I'd like to also thank Steve Anderson, who's the executive director of Open Media, and my daytime boss. He's been working on media reform in Canada for a really long time and was one of MDD's really early leaders and organizers who helped turn it into a great platform for media activism. He continues to be a crucial champion and one of my personal, a great personal friend in championing MDD. Great. A couple sponsors really quick. Sorry. Couple sponsors really quick. We'd like to thank BCGEU, SFU's Office of the Vice President, SFU's Faculty of Communication, Art, and Technology, the BC Fed, UBC School of Journalism, SFU Institute for the Humanities, and dozens more that you can see in the back pages of our program guide. Without their support, this never could have happened, and we wouldn't have pretty program guides to print their logos in. So thank you very much to our sponsors. So, okay, the reason you're all here. or at least the first reason, chronologically speaking. We have a whole afternoon of exciting panels. You can see in your guides, if you have any questions, you can ask any one of our volunteers who are very knowledgeable and can get you where you need to go. But first, I'd like to introduce our keynote, Dr. Michael Geist. He is a law professor at the University of Ottawa, where he holds the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-Commerce. Dr. Geist is a syndicated columnist on technology and probably well known to many people in this room. He has a regular column that appears in the Tyee and the Toronto Star. Speaking personally, I can say that he is a crucial lifeline for those of us working in media reform, particularly on intellectual property issues and the internet. And so thank you for providing that platform and service to all of us. He's probably the most cited expert in anything, in all of the materials open media has ever written. And in our office, you can usually see his website open on any given laptop at any given time. So without further ado, I'm going to welcome Dr. Geist to the stage to talk to you all.
Great. Well, thanks very much for that introduction. You know, there's quite a few seats here. If you want to stand, feel free. But if you want to take a seat, I see in this area there's a bunch of seats, too. I don't think it'll be too disruptive to go sit down if you like. So I want to start by thanking the organizers for the invitation. This is a truly amazing event, and to hear how many times it's happened and the kind of community that it's brought together, I think is a terrifically exciting thing. I have to say I was flipping through the program before we started, and you should all be, I think, incredibly excited and proud about what BC has when it comes to organizations that are active in the area. I mean, you punch, frankly, well above your weight relative to what takes place in the rest of the country. I don't think there's any region in the country at all that can boast organizations like Open Media and BC FIPA and BCCLA and the whole range of other groups that you could see in the back of the program. It's a great thing and something that I think you should all be proud of. So I'm really pleased, as I say, to be here. As you can see, the subject of my talk described the field of dreams, public participation in Canadian digital policy. So I want to focus specifically on how the internet and the digital environment has been used from a digital policy perspective, and start by noting that today, for those that aren't aware, is Aaron Swartz Day. Aaron Swartz would have been 28 today. I'm sure he's someone who's familiar to most, but for those of you who aren't familiar with Aaron, he was one of the true leaders when it comes to digital policy issues, often credited as one of the founders of everything from RSS to Reddit, was active, of course, on issues pertaining to SOPA, which I'll talk about in just a moment, and active as well on more broadly on things like open access. And so it's appropriate, I think, not just that we hold this event on Aaron Swartz Day, but also hold it in a library. Where Aaron's activities were by and large designed to try to make the kinds of information that we find on the shelves and that are readily accessible throughout this building more widely accessible to all. Now, Aaron's in some ways best known or became best known, well, I suppose he became best known for what happened at the very end of his life and his arrest. But before that, it was this photo and photos like it when he was involved in the fight against SOPA and PIPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, an episode that I think will be familiar to many of you, starting several years ago with the introduction of legislation in the United States, sort of yet another so-called internet piracy bill. And at the time, it was widely expected that that legislation would pass and pass quite quickly. If we think back to several years ago, back to 2011 when it was first introduced, it was the lead piece of legislation from what is, I think, generally recognized as one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, lobby group in the United States, sort of the content industry, whether the movie industry, the music industry, and the like. And so when it started moving forward, there was every expectation that this piece of legislation, given the kind of backing that it had in the United States, would pass. Now, as many of you know, this stands as one of the real success stories, with any number of different ways that people were trying to combat and challenge and raise awareness. There was the Free Bieber campaign, which I must admit I found to be the most confusing part of it. It wasn't clear to me that telling people that Bieber would be in jail for a few years would get you to support their campaign or not. But nevertheless, it was one that spoke to kind of some of the creativity that was out there to try to make people aware. Perhaps the best-known image from the Stop Online Piracy fight was this one that millions of people woke up to one morning where Wikipedia engaged in the blackout over a 24-hour period. Over 100 million attempts over the course of that day to access Wikipedia resulted in accessing this page, urging people to imagine a world without free knowledge and think about the implications of this legislation. And the impact, as I'm sure many of you will know, was immediate and dramatic. This from ProPublica highlights support for this legislation sort of the day before the Wikipedia blackout and quite literally the day after. The day before, a fair number of members of Congress expressing support for the legislation and a very small number who at the time had come out opposed. It took no more than 24 or 48 hours for that to flip quite dramatically as many people switched over and said that they were now coming out against the legislation, and then a couple of days later, the Obama administration made it clear that this legislation wasn't going anywhere either, and the sponsors behind it pulled it back. Now, that stands, I think, for many as sort of one of the best-known kinds of these incidents, but there are many others. In fact, we see them sometimes almost on a weekly or monthly basis. Just over the last couple of weeks, for example, in Hungary, there was an announcement that they were going to begin to tax the Internet. Not tax in the sense that the so-called Netflix tax that we sometimes have seen some debates about here, but a genuine, real tax on people accessing the Internet. That drew tens of thousands of people to the streets within about a week in Hungary, protesting the prospect of making access to the Internet, that critically important communications device, less accessible to many. And within a matter of days after that, the Hungarian government indicated that it was planning to drop this as well. So we see these kind of success stories take place around the world, and there are some that say, well, why not here? If we can see this taking place in the United States, if we can see it taking place here in Hungary and other parts around the world, why not in Canada as well? Well, I'm here to tell you that in some ways, digital advocacy is one of Canada's, I think, not-so-secret success stories. We have actually done far better on digital policies in particular than I think is often acknowledged. I mean, there is at times reasons to feel a bit depressed or down about the policies that we sometimes see on different digital issues, and there is good reason for that. But at the same time, particularly for people who are interested and concerned about how we can become more actively engaged in a democratic way from a policy perspective, and especially around these kinds of digital issues, if we look back, I think in many respects we can identify some real change here, some real positive messages and experiences. So, for example, if I go back to 2007, not that long ago, 7 years ago, and think of what the policy environment was from a digital perspective, at the time we had an industry minister by the name of Maxime Bernier, who just sort of at the very end of December had announced a new hands-off approach with respect to the CRTC, Canada's telecom and broadcast regulator. Bernier was a very strong, and still is a very strong, libertarian minister within the government, the view that government regulation was simply something that he wanted to try to avoid. And so his view, particularly on telecom policy, was that the CRTC ought to take a hands-off approach. The kinds of concerns that we see today around competition, from his perspective, didn't matter in the sense that a far better approach, in his view, was take a hands-off approach when it came to regulation. And so there was a policy direction issued to the CRTC that it ought to let market rules apply in every circumstance possible. Market forces was the way to go. That was 7 years ago. At the same time, right around that same time, Department of Public Safety launched a consultation on lawful access. Legislation that had long been in the pipeline in Canada and still is. We'll talk a bit more about it in a few minutes. This particular consultation was one that they launched that was seeking to identify the rules around when Internet providers could disclose customer name and address information. And unlike the debate that would follow in years later about whether or not Internet providers should be disclosing information on a mandatory basis or whether warrants are appropriate, this particular consultation said there was no question as to whether or not it would be mandatory. The only question was what sort of rules would we put around that particular issue. So that was the thinking at the time of that particular government. A month or so later, or 2 months later, the government was about to introduce copyright legislation. The minister at that time, Jim Prentice, with bill that appeared on the order paper and legislation, as again I'll talk about in just a few minutes, that really thought of only locking things down and not thinking about sort of flexibilities that are relied upon by consumers, by many artists, by innovative companies, and the like. Internationally, Canada signed on to the negotiations for the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, ACTA, becoming one of a number of countries, including the United States, Europe, and several others, that talked about a new higher-level protection when it came to counterfeiting and intellectual property issues. Those negotiations taking place largely in secret with no active participation, even no public awareness of what was taking place, as no texts were made available. Indeed, in the early days, when this announcement took place, even the locations of the negotiations were by and large kept secret. So that's where we were in 2007, not that long ago. Now quickly think of where we are today. From a telecom and broadcast policy perspective, actually Jean-Pierre Blais, the chair of the CRTC, was in Vancouver just this week and gave a talk, I believe, at the Board of Trade, where he spoke again openly about the CRTC's focus on consumer issues. A desire, as you can see there, to rebuild consumer trust. They have appointed someone whose only focus is on ensuring that there is a consumer perspective brought to bear. When we think of some of the various policies that they're pursuing right now, it's very much focused on consumer-oriented issues. We've seen the emergence of the wireless code. So for years, we had telecom companies argue that they could self-regulate, that the market, in a sense, was sufficient, and yet now we have a mandatory wireless code, and in the reports that came out this week, we do see that the number of complaints have declined with some of the providers, and that the wireless code is having an impact on a number of issues, contract length and the like. We've seen the government, and it's certainly been the subject ongoing of some criticism, but having adopted a wireless policy that is focused primarily on more competition, hasn't worked as well as I think some would hope, and there are a number of reasons that we can get into for that. But I don't think that anybody can doubt that the primary focus has been how do we find ways to bring more competitors into the market, even at the cost of fighting with companies, the so-called big telecom, that for many years they seem to be at Edom with and working with. From a copyright law perspective, and as I say, we'll talk a bit more about that as well, we went from a bill in 2007 or a potential bill in 2007 that largely excluded consumer-oriented focus and new flexibilities to a bill that was ultimately passed in 2012 that adopted a far more consumer user-friendly approach than, frankly, almost anyone might have thought possible. Indeed, many point to it as being one of the most consumer-friendly bills when it comes to copyright that has been passed in recent years anywhere in the world. And when we think about what ultimately came of ACTA, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, this particular scene here from the European Parliament, as protests across Europe on ACTA, spurred on by activity that was taking place in countries around the world, including here in Canada, led the EU members of Parliament to stand up and vote overwhelmingly against passing of ACTA, holding, as you can see, aloft signs, "Hello, democracy, goodbye, ACTA," something that certainly in 2007 would have seemed positively unthinkable, that an internationally negotiated trade agreement, one conducted largely in secret, might have been passed and signed and negotiated and yet months later rejected by elected officials in Europe. And so a lot has changed. Well, what happened? Now, I think there's a couple of ways of looking at it, some which I think will be obvious and apparent to many in this audience who have been active on many of these very issues. We've seen, I think, for one, a mainstreaming in many respects of many of these digital issues. Indeed, I think our government and other governments increasingly recognizing that digital policy issues are not some niche issue that sort of that belong just to the geeks and the people off in the corner, but rather basic terms of access, competitiveness of those marketplaces, appropriate flexibilities when it comes to things like intellectual property, full access to knowledge are issues that matter to us all. Indeed, in some instances, they are so economically important that people are willing to vote on it, and that recognition of that mainstreaming, something that, as I mentioned, we would see in a place like Hungary, where tens of thousands of people would take to the streets to say, taxing something that for me is as important as heat and food on the table in many respects, that ability to communicate and be part of my community is something that is wrong and is something that I'll reject. So too, and there are many here who are experts on this in the room, the tools that are now available to people to have their voices heard. Previously, if we go back to 2007 or even earlier, I think it's fair to say that in many instances there were people who were concerned, but their voices in some instances were largely marginalized because the tools that they could employ simply weren't as readily accessible, and there wasn't the attention being paid in certain respects by those that mattered. And finally, it seems to me, we also have this nice combining of both policy and politics, so that on some issues, good digital policy is also good digital politics. And so it helps when government can recognize that taking a strong position, let's say, on better competition when it comes to wireless isn't just good policy, isn't just something that will help make these technologies more accessible and affordable to all, but it is also good politics as well, because there is the potential that people will recognize and reward those that adopt those kinds of positions. So at a certain level, we've seen that kind of emergence, and that's what's, and I think that's been one, some of the drivers. But what I really wanted to spend most of my time here today talking about is sort of a different kind of perspective, to see some of the evolution of some of this, sort of a couple of case studies, and then talk both about what I see as almost three stages. This emergence of a public voice, and again, talk about several of the issues, again, some of which, or experiences, some of which will be familiar to many of you. Talk a bit about how the regulators and how the government have caught up or sought to catch up to that emergence of a public voice, and sometimes where some of their strategies themselves have taken a back seat, how they have struggled or at times attempted to try to combat what's taking place. And then perhaps most importantly, talk a bit about some of the future challenges. Well, because I project some amount of, I suppose, sunny optimism when it comes to some of the successes that we've had, I think we ought to recognize that there are still challenges, significant challenges, both for people in this room and many of the communities that they actively engage in, but I think notably challenges for the regulators and governments as well, even if one is to believe that they come in with good intentions or at least a desire to better reflect some of the kinds of things that are coming in as inputs. I want to talk a bit about some of those challenges. Let's start then with the emergence of the public voice. And I have to say, of all the issues that have driven telecom policy, it's one that in many respects people in this room have had a dramatic impact on. It's usage-based billing, UBB, which I think would strike most sort of uninformed observers or someone who just comes at this all new and says, well, what have been some of the defining issues around digital policy that have had an impact? And if someone were to say, well, it was fees and caps on internet usage, it would be, frankly, would be scarcely believed, I think, that that would have the kind of impact that it had. But I would argue that it has had, perhaps more than almost any other issue, a dramatic impact, especially on the telecom side. We go back several years when the CRTC approved a usage-based billing scheme, one in which that would allow the larger players like Bell and others, and Telus, I suppose, who were selling on to other providers, independent internet providers, to put in new caps at a wholesale level. We already are familiar with it in many respects as consumers, but this would move it down the chain, or up the chain, I suppose, to the wholesale providers and their ability to compete and differentiate themselves in the marketplace, something that is seen, I think, by many as critically essential to ensure that you can get more competition into the marketplace, would have been dramatically compromised. Now, what happened in response is that we had some of those independent providers begin to speak out. Companies like TechSavvy, for example, which are well-known where I live in Ottawa, Ontario, began to speak out in large measure because they would, of course, be directly affected, and by extension, so too would tens of thousands of their customers. The NGO, or the group that played by far the largest role on this issue, was, of course, Open Media, talking about with their campaign about minding the cap, of which over 500,000 people signed up and began to ensure that there was a voice there. I participated in an event several years ago, with Tony Clement, who was the industry minister at the time, and Clement confided to everyone, so he didn't really confide, but he stated that the number of people that spoke out on this issue was at that point in time the largest campaign that government had ever seen on any issue. They receive more correspondence on usage-based billing than anything else. Now, I'm not here to say that that's necessarily a good thing. It seems to me that there are a lot of really important issues that one would have thought more people would be speaking out on rather than UBB. But I state it rather just as a fact. This is what the minister stated. It wasn't just online. We saw some offline activities too. But the impact, as I think many of you will know, was profound. Within just a matter of days, as the thousands and then tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands began to speak out and express concern about where the CRTC policy was going and what would it mean both for their own bills as well as for competition in the marketplace. You recall somewhat infamously Tony Clement, then the industry minister, tweeted out that there was going to be change on this policy and that if the CRTC didn't take it upon itself to adopt a new approach, that the government would do it for it. The CRTC got the message, it changed the policy, but the government's perspective on what telecom policy meant was, I believe, forever changed. As it came to the conclusion that if a half a million people were prepared to speak out about UBB, lying behind that was many, many people who were thinking about this as a simple pocketbook issue, as an issue that mattered because the amount we spend on a monthly and yearly basis on our communication services, whether that's for internet or for wireless, is an increasingly large portion of what we spend generally each month. And if the government could have an impact on dealing with some of those costs, in a sense, there were votes in it. Its policy on telecom, both in terms of the kinds of directions that it has given to the CRTC and its approach that it has adopted government-wide within Industry Canada, whether it was trying to open things up to foreign investment, trying to get companies like Verizon into the marketplace, creating spectrum auctions that have set-asides to try to help new entrants, has been driven, I would argue, from the very beginning now through the UBB campaign. Because as I noted off the top, it wasn't that long ago that you had an industry minister that took, in a sense, a diametrically opposed view, one in which he said, market forces, government stands back. That's not the approach anymore. We get, in certain respects, a similar story when it comes to copyright. I'll go back just a little further to 2005, when the then Liberal government introduced its copyright bill that didn't go very far. It was known as Bill C-60. And as you can see from the chart up there, you'll find that there was nothing with respect to expanding things like fair dealing, nothing with respect to education or improved access. None of the consumer exceptions were there. None of the internet-related exceptions were there. No changes to statutory damages with threat, in some instances, to bankrupt people for a number of different infringements. And so the legislation perspective at the time, the legislative perspective at the time of the government was one that was almost wholly focused on stronger rights and more restrictions. Now, right around that time, we saw the budding of a campaign on copyright. In this particular case, it started with this Liberal Toronto area Liberal MP named Sam Bolte, who was the chair of the Standing Committee on Canadian Heritage and the Parliamentary Secretary for Canadian Heritage. In other words, that made her the second most powerful person on the copyright file within the broader Canadian Heritage portfolio. Only the minister would have been ahead of her. And if some of you may be familiar around the election campaign in the 2005-2006 campaign, it's the one that sort of went over in late December and straddled into January, there was a fundraiser planned for Ms. Bolte 4 days before the election campaign. The sponsors of that campaign were Doug Frith, who headed the Motion Picture Association in Canada, Graham Henderson, who was head of the music industry, Jackie Hushin, head of the publishers, Labossiere, who headed the Entertainment Software Association, and Stephen Stone, who was the producer of Degrassi. The performer at that event, as you can see, Margot Timmins of the Cowboy Junkies, who happens to be married to Graham Henderson. 4 days before an election campaign, the four biggest copyright lobby groups in the country holding openly a fundraiser for the second most powerful person on copyright policy in the country. Well, I blogged about it, as did a number of other people, and the episode came to be known, at least by Maclean's, as Bolte versus the bloggers. At the time, it was an issue that really did begin to take hold in that Toronto area riding of Parkdale High Park. In fact, at the very first all-candidates meeting taking place in the proverbial church basement, that all the candidates were asked about the issue. I think I'd blogged something talking about candidates taking the copyright pledge. And the pledge that I had in mind was that if you were going to be in a position of being a minister or parliamentary secretary, you would undertake not to take any funding at all from any stakeholders that were interested or engaged on copyright policy. The other candidates on the riding all said that they would take the pledge, including the NDP candidate at the time, Peggy Nash, who is now, I think, someone who's quite familiar to many of you. And Ms. Bolte, the Liberal candidate, responded by saying that she wouldn't let Michael Geist and the Electronic Frontier Foundation zealots try to intimidate her and silence her, which I took to be a no. In terms of the pledge. Now, interestingly, there was actually someone in the room who recorded it and sent me an email saying, you know, I was there and this is what happened. I recorded it, and he told me, and I put it up on YouTube. And I said, you put it up on where? And YouTube at the time had literally just come out of beta to show just how, you know, just how fast things have moved, in a sense, since that time. But the issue took hold in that riding, and so that by the time we had the election campaign or the voting in late January, you had, if you were briefly on the Globe site, you had the sort of headline there, Bloggers United, Sam Bolte defeated, hats off to Michael Geist. So my mom was really happy, which was kind of cool. But was interesting about this was that this was a time, you may recall, we were having a lot of elections. We had successive minority governments. And in the entire Toronto area in the GTA, there were only two ridings that actually flipped during that election campaign from the prior election only 18 months earlier. One was Olivia Chow's riding, and she ran for the first time. And the other was this riding that switched by more than 5,000 votes in a circumstance when really nothing else had changed. Now, it wasn't purely about copyright, to be sure. I think more fundamentally it was about ethics and the ethics of a position in of someone in power taking on that issue. But at the same time, what it signaled was that this was an issue that people would become engaged on. And in the months that followed, we began to see groups become actively engaged, using the internet as a platform to begin to speak out, groups like this one, the Canadian Music Creators Coalition, which began to speak out saying that the recording industry wasn't representing their views on these issues, artist groups, including Art Appropriation Art that originated from here in BC, privacy groups that talked about the privacy implications of some of these kinds of reforms. All of this leading up to that attempt in 2007 by Jim Prentice to launch a new copyright bill. Now, my involvement or my story in this comes up with this group, this Facebook group here, Fair Copyright for Canada, which I launched about a week before the bill was to have been introduced. I hesitate to do so, but I will admit to be a Leaf fan. And it was a Saturday night. The Leafs had lost yet again. That happens a lot. And so I was looking for something to do, which also shows you how exciting my life is. But in any event, Leafs had lost, looking for something to do. We've got a copyright bill coming up. And so I launched this group. The bill's coming out. And at the time, while by today it sounds positively unremarkable to say that I thought, well, we could use social media to get people more aware and engaged on these issues. At the time, it was still fairly early. It was 2007. And so first 500 join, and then 1,000 and 2,000, and there's 10,000 people that joined it after the first week, and 20,000, ultimately about 90,000 people joined this group. And for the government, that had not at that time really faced a social media campaign, they quite frankly didn't know what to do. So we saw these kinds of headlines in papers across the country, first about people becoming actively engaged, and then ultimately about the government deciding to actually hold off on introducing this legislation. The Globe and Mail, for example, had a pair of headlines. The first, how did copyright become cool? Something that I must admit I still can't quite convince my kids of. but nevertheless was one that at least the Globe was talking, people were talking about this issue. And the other that I must admit I never thought we would see, this was on the front page of the Globe and Mail one Saturday morning, Ottawa accused of caving into Hollywood on copyright. It was actually a Canadian Libraries Association event on Parliament Hill the day before that led to that particular headline, demonstrating the impact that librarians in the education community had and continue to have on some of these issues. Now, Prentice, as it turns out, was about to have had a holiday party just days before the election campaign was going to happen. I blogged about it, so did a number of other people, and so about 60 people showed up at his riding office in Calgary, some people driving from Edmonton down to Calgary just for a couple of minutes with the minister about a bill that hadn't even been introduced yet. Now, the bill itself ultimately gets delayed, although it comes back 6 months later, And at that point in time, when it's reintroduced in June 2008, many of the same groups, emboldened by what had taken place the prior December, now become even more active and vocal. Industry Canada receives more than 30,000 physical letters in June of 2008 expressing concern about this copyright bill. That Facebook group that I started spawns a whole series of local chapters, including one here in Vancouver, some using Facebook to do it, others, as you see here in Montreal, using a wiki platform to find find people in the community concerned, to identify local area MPs, and to begin to develop a strategy of speaking out in a true grassroots effort about this particular legislation. We had things like Google Maps that highlighted media coverage, tracking it with red, in this case, being negative, yellow was neutral, and blue was positive, and so there wasn't a whole lot of positive coverage at the time, but you could link through and see the coverage itself. We used things like Google Calendar to track meetings that were taking place across the country. There was even T-shirts and mugs, which my wife would like me to clear out of our closet. But nevertheless, we had all that kind of swag. We even had C61 in 61 seconds. That was the name of the bill. And so we had a video contest that was launched with people like Ontario Privacy Commissioner Anne Kavoukian and Stephen Page, then the Bare Naked Ladies, were some of the judges. And the impact of this was such that we had MPs, a number of MPs from across the country, including from this part of the country, Sukh Dhaliwal, holding town hall meetings on the issue of copyright. Copyright. In the summer of 2008. Now, that particular bill died as well, as once again there was an election call, and the impact of all of that was when the government came back, it said, we aren't going to jump right back into this bill again. Instead, it held a copyright consultation. And it was a consultation, and I should note as a starting point that in many instances we find that not a lot of people show up to government consultations. It's rather discouraging and somewhat disappointing that when they actually do ask the question, what do you think, in many instances very few people show up to say what they think. But in this instance, more than 8,000 people came out to speak out on this particular issue, which is almost an unprecedented number when it comes to some of these kinds of consultations. So much so that a year later, when the government came back with legislation, they were now calling it balanced copyright. And if we take a look at the kinds of things that made it into this bill, ultimately passed, as I mentioned, in 2012, new exceptions in fair dealing for things like parody and satire for artists and education for the education community, a whole series of new exceptions like time shifting and format shifting and backup copies, new internet exceptions. Things like user-generated content. We're the only country in the world that has a non-commercial user-generated content exception that provides legal protection both for those that create non-commercial USG as well as sites that host that same kinds of content so that it need not be taken down. And we had new rules with respect to statutory damages designed to create a cap on liability for non-commercial infringement so that many, including those accused of things like peer-to-peer file sharing as well as schools and others that previously feared facing hundreds of thousands or millions in liability, needn't fear that anymore. And thirdly, and quite quickly, there's the story of lawful access, which is one that is still playing out, but in some ways represents a win in terms of where the government has gone. This debate goes back well over a decade or more, but what we have seen is successive change when it comes to some of the rules around lawful access. So perhaps best known, of course, to many here will be the VICTAES bill, the so-called Protecting Children from Internet Predators Act, the bill that in the day before was when it was raised in the House of Commons, Tay somewhat infamously suggested that people either stand with the government on this bill or side with the child pornographers. Many, of course, if faced with that choice, ultimately said, well, they would side with the child pornographers if that's the choice, when it came to the kind of legislative provisions that were included there. And so once again, groups began to speak out, open media once again playing a critical role. But so too privacy commissioners, this is Anne Kavoukian in Ontario's website, who was herself trying to crowdsource active participation. This was the Liberal site doing much the same kind of thing, speaking out on these kinds of issues. There were as well genuine grassroots efforts, by far my favorite. Some of you may recall is the Telvic Everything campaign, a Twitter campaign that went with the hashtag Telvic Everything, the idea being if the government was going to engage in surveillance, you might as well tell them everything anyway. By far my favorite tweet on all of this was this one here. For the benefit of those that may be listening to this on the radio from the record, hey VICTAES, I lost an email from my work account yesterday. Can I get your copy? Now, Who says you can't do a lot in 140 characters, right? I mean, it is rather amazing that this conveys both the concern associated with this bill and is pretty funny at the same time. Now, Taze was actually asked about this several days later on CBC's The House, and he said he found it funny. But if you are a politician and that they are laughing at you rather than with you, you know that you're sunk. Within a number of days later, the government put the bill on hold, and a year later, it actually indicated that it was going to kill the bill altogether. Now, they undertook that they wouldn't bring it back, a promise that lasted about 6 months, because the bill itself did come back. But if we are fair about this bill, a bill that currently is now being studied at the Senate, it has passed through the House of Commons, I think it's fair to acknowledge that some of the core concerns that were expressed with the Taze bill, ubiquitous surveillance required to be embedded within network provider systems, as well as mandatory disclosure of personal information, both of those elements have been removed from the bill. There are problems with this bill, to be sure. I actually get a chance to appear before the Senate committee in a couple of weeks, and I'll tell them about it, even though I'm not holding my breath that we'll see any changes. But nevertheless, there is an impact here. Indeed, if we were to even go back further, we would find that the list of mandatory of items that would be mandatorily disclosed gradually shrunk until the point now it has been removed altogether. And if coupled with this summer's decision from the Supreme Court of Canada, the Spencer decision, it becomes pretty clear that voluntary disclosure without a warrant is going to become less and less common practice here in Canada. There have been dramatic changes here. Now, those are some of, I think, the good news stories where we've seen that kind of activity. Now, how have people tried to catch up to this? Because it's clear, it's not just a one-off. We now see this happening or have seen this happen on a number of occasions here in Canada. Well, the government has, at a minimum, said we're willing to consult, or at least active to consult. So I mentioned the copyright file, but we see it in other areas as well. Tony Clement this week unveiled his new open government plan. Sadly, doesn't include anything with respect to access to information, which is desperately in need of reform, but nevertheless does include a number of areas, and there was those kinds of open consultations. In other countries, we see even more. So there are governments there that have tried to crowdsource legislation or provide templates or formats in other countries here in South Korea that have provided more and more tools for people to become actively involved with government saying we're in a sense open for business and willing to hear from the public and more actively engaged in a truly more iterative kind of copyright, truly iterative policy approach. Regulators have tried to do some of the same kinds of things. And so I already referenced the CRTC with some of its efforts. If you take a look, for example, at its plans and priorities, it's very focused on more actively being open. The Let's Talk TV series of hearings would be a good example of that, where they have tried to make things more readily accessible to people and tried to make it more open in the sense that people can actively participate and ensure that those voices are heard. Indeed, the shift that we saw was, I think, most dramatic early on. It was, I think, during the Bell-Astral media merger, part one. The CRTC would proceed to deny it, although they later approved that particular merger. But some of you may recall, many people here, of course, focus on media issues, that Bell CEO George Cope appeared at that particular hearing and the chair, Jean-Pierre Blais, with the CEO of BCE sitting in front of him began to take out individual comments that they had received from Canadians and asked Cope to respond to the kinds of concerns that were being expressed by individuals. It's fair to say Bell is, I think, the best prepared organization before CRTC hearings. If you follow these hearings, Bell does it better than anyone else. But the one thing that they had not prepared for was the idea that the chair of the CRTC would literally pull out individual comments from Canadians and ask for a response from the CEO. It's fair to say they're ready for that now, but that's a pretty dramatic change in the way even the regulatory hearings themselves are conducted. CRTC tries to engage even in real time on Twitter. There's times when people have questions. Is there a document available as the hearing is taking place? And they respond using a Twitter feed in real time. I mentioned already Let's Talk TV and the way that they try to engage with that in a number of different ways, recognizing that some of these issues are difficult for the average Canadian to understand and engage in. You shouldn't have to be an expert on broadcast policy to know that you've got concerns with what your cable bill looks like. And yet the CRTC has sought to find ways to allow people to more actively engage and ensure that those voices are heard. It's not just the CRTC. The Privacy Commissioner has done much the same thing over the years with consultations that have taken place on a number of different issues to help identify priorities. So too is the Competition Bureau. in recent years, including this one here, where they actually asked, what do you want us to advocate on? And asked Canadians to speak out to help identify some of the Bureau's own advocacy priorities. And if you have been following some of the wireless competition issues, you know that the Competition Bureau has become an active voice on the wireless competition issue as well, submitting papers and commissioning studies, specifically arguing that the big three have so-called market power, which from a competition law perspective means they've got the ability to alter prices or maintain pricing in a manner that we wouldn't otherwise expect in a truly competitive marketplace. Now, perhaps most interesting is the way that stakeholders have responded. And we've, of course, talked about how those groups that previously didn't have a strong voice responded to speak out. But I want to think about some of the others and the way they've spoken out, or at least they've responded. I think it's fair to say that initially, some of the big players are a bit shocked by all of this. So, for example, back in the Prentice days on copyright, the music industry put out releases when it appeared that the government might delay the legislation to say, this can't possibly be happening. You're not really thinking about delaying this legislation, are you? But of course they were. Bell said that they were shocked, that this transaction hasn't gone forward. And indeed others, on copyright consultations, there's been at times attempts to try to demean or suggest that somehow these rules just, those voices just aren't as legitimate as their voices might be. Their approach, once they get over the surprise and shock, has been that if you can't beat them, join them. And so we now see some of the same kinds of tools and techniques being used. Balanced Copyright for Canada, for example, was the response to Fair Copyright for Canada. This is a site that was launched by the recording industry. Or things like Local TV Matters, where they try to use Twitter as a mechanism to get people active and excited. Now, finally, in my last, I think, 5 minutes, I hope, let me talk a little bit about the future challenges. Now, for this community, for our community on the advocacy side, I think there are a number of challenges. We have to recognize, as I just referenced, that flattery, that imitation is the best form of flattery, I think, as they say. And so in this context, many of the kinds of campaigns that may have worked in the past will be increasingly imitated and their effectiveness increasingly dulled. I think we all must recognize that this requires constant and consistent innovation. What worked in the last campaign won't necessarily work in the next. And so for those that think there is some magic recipe out there, some formula that will allow for effectiveness for voices to speak out and ensure that they are heard, I think the experience to date suggests that every time we look at many of these different success stories, what marks them isn't their commonality, but in certain respects, their differences. Their commonality certainly is with respect to the broad digital policy umbrella, but is their differences, their strategic differences, the different kinds of tools they use, their different mechanisms in terms of trying to ensure that their voices are heard, points to the need for constant innovation in this area. There is also, I think, a desperate need to translate the things that are important to us in this space to the rest of the community. Not everybody is an expert on these issues, and not everybody should be an expert on this issue. I mean, they can be. The more people who have expertise, great, but you shouldn't have to be an expert to be concerned, to ensure that you have a voice, and to ensure that their voice is heard, and finding ways to take issues that to some may seem still as niche or overly complex and complicated requires constant effort to ensure that they translate more effectively. And there is also, finally, I think, a need to get over the issue of exhaustion. Weekly emails about the sky falling yet again, about the challenges yet again. It's happening again and again and again. Maybe necessary in some instances when we're getting to the very end of the issue, but people eventually turn off from everything if they hear the same message too frequently. And finding ways, and this is, I guess, part of that same innovation story to engage, I think is critically important. But perhaps just as important as the kind of things we think about are the kinds of things that government needs to be thinking about. Government, I think, needs to be far more innovative as well. There's a failure to experiment in many governments around some of these policy processes because government, in many instances, does not fully reward innovation. They certainly punish failure. You know that if you get something wrong, you're going to end up on the front page of the Globe or the Post or some other newspaper, and that creates strong disincentives to be innovative from a policy perspective. Government has to get over that. And they have to begin to become more active when it comes to experimentation. They've got to find ways